The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Sunday worship for the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. Our fellowship is a principle-based, truth-seeking, justice-seeking, welcoming faith community in Collegeville, Pennsylvania, and on the web at tpuuf.org, and wherever you may be joining us via Zoom this morning. I'm Jerry Lazzaro. I have the honor and privilege of chairing the worship committee here at the Thomas Paine UU Fellowship. On behalf of the committee and the fellowship as a whole, I want you to know that you, whoever you are, from wherever you've come, wherever you may be on your life's journey, on your spiritual journey, whatever you must in conscience truly and responsibly believe, however you identify or express your gender, whomever you love, you are welcome here and heartily invited to worship with us this morning and every Sunday morning. Today we have a special service that's become something of a tradition in our fellowship. In this service, we ask several members and friends to share with us their experience of reading a book that's made an impression on them and to tell us about what they gleaned from that experience that may be of interest to all of us here at the fellowship. The title is a bit tongue-in-cheek because usually the idea of a summer read is something light and entertaining, you know, the quintessential beach book, something to divert the mind while you wriggle your toes in the sand and soak in the warmth of the sun and the sound of the waves, relaxing your body, right? If that were the case, I would have put on my bathing suit and beach top and a hat and kind of donned these sunglasses and been up here. But that's not the case this morning. Whoops, sorry. That's not the case this morning. Our speakers this morning have chosen something a little bit more meatier, delving into deeper waters of human thought and emotion. And I think that's true for many of us. We have a little more time in the summer to delve into things that we said, oh, you know, I need some time to get into that, right? I remember throughout my teaching career, I used to devote the summers to a really kind of reading project. One summer I read all the works of John Keats, autobiographies of him, his letters and everything, you know. Another summer, I read all the essays of Ralph Waldo Emerson, something like that. Just really got into it, you know. And why? Because I had more time to devote to reading projects that, you know, didn't directly relate to my teaching and research. And our guest speakers this morning incline more towards books that deal with weightier subjects, as I said, with reading for enlightenment and inspiration rather than pure entertainment. They're representative of the friends and members of this congregation, I think, in that they consider learning and sharing what they learn of importance to them in their growth and development. And I would suggest that reading, in no small matter, is a spiritual journey. I'll explain why in some reflections following the lighting of our chalice and a peace lamp and the singing of our gathering song. And I'm going to ask now Mike Berkheimer, who leads our book discussion group at the Fellowship, to recite the chalice lighting words while I light the chalice. Just want to say, if you haven't been part of the book discussion group here at TPUF, you might want to try it out sometime. It meets once a month, usually after worship on the final Sunday of the month. Selections run the gamut from classic novels like To Kill a Mockingbird and Wuthering Heights, to more contemporary fiction, such as Where the Crawdads Sing. Some of you may remember that. It was made into a movie a couple years ago. And Station 11, to nonfiction books that provide analysis and insight into the real history of this country and its social structure, and deal with contemporary issues, like Why Men and Boys Are Struggling and Founding Brothers. So, next week is kind of different. It's a BYOB week. Bring your own book. That is, you know, you can talk about any book that you've been reading that you'd like to share with others. And so this might be a good week to get your feet wet in our book discussion group. Now I'll turn the mic over to Mike Berkheimer.
The chalice and the flame form the symbol of our free faith. They signify, among many things, our openness to the wisdom of many ages and traditions, and our aspiration to keep the light of truth, the warmth of compassion, and the fire of commitment burning within ourselves and throughout the world. We light our chalice this morning to recognize the light that the written word shines on our world and within our hearts. The light has come. The light is the power to brighten dark days into warm, cold nights. It can shine a light on lives and experiences we know little or nothing of. It can bring to light aspects of the human condition that some may wish would remain hidden or unknown. It can encourage us to think and act more purposely and more humanely. As the great French novelist Victor Hugo, author of the masterpiece Les Misérables, once wrote, "To learn to read is to light a fire. Every syllable that is spelled out is a spark." You like this peace lamp? Please respond with the words on the screen. May peace be with us.
Thank you, Mike. I forgot to mention, if you have your cell phone with you, you might want to turn it off or put it on mute. I have this neat little function on mine that turns it off for a certain period of time. I can time it. So I have mine set 2 hours from now, it'll go back on. There you go. Our gathering song this morning is a setting of the lyrics of hymn number 158 in our gray hymnal. It's a different setting than the one in our hymnal. This setting of the words, "Praise the source of faith and learning," is a tune so frequently used in hymnals, not just in our denomination, but every denomination, that it has its own nickname. Oh, it's a Welsh word. That means only a Welshman or Welshwoman can possibly pronounce it, so I did the best I could. This is what the best I could come up with. Try it out. Browse. Pronounce and you're going to get something that sounds like, what? I think my computer sound is off or something, right? Okay. Right. At any rate, the tune is quite familiar to us. There are three songs in our gray hymnal that are set to this tune. And one, a favorite here, "Blue Boat Home," which is in our teal hymnal. So we know this tune, and so I think we can all join in singing it heartily. If you wish to stand, kind of stand off so you don't block anyone's view of the screen, the lyrics will be in the video. And this is being led by Heidi Tucci, a pianist and vocalist. "Praise the Source of Faith and Learning."
Source of faith and learning that has sparked and stored.
Is recessional, but I don't think we have, is that, we don't have anybody leaving this morning, so we don't need to sing the children's recessional, John. So we can go right to readings, reflections on reading as a spiritual practice. I know you as I are looking forward to hearing from our two members and one friend of the fellowship who share their thoughts on a book that made its impression on them and they would like to share their thoughts on with us. But just allow me to reflect for a few moments on reading as a spiritual practice. Okay. If you search on the phrase reading as spiritual practice in your browser, you'll find that just about every hit, I tried it by the way, every hit involves encouragement to read the Bible regularly and to read it slowly, mindfully, right? Now, that's understandable, given the status of the Bible in Western religious thought. But you know that the Quran, the most sacred Islamic text, refers to Christians and Jews as people of the book. People of the book. Why? Because in the Judeo-Christian tradition, as in Islam, one book and one book only is considered the primary source of faith and learning, right? One book deemed definitive and sacred, plays a central role in what Jews, Christians, and Muslims believe, and how, ostensibly, to put that belief into practice, right? Or at least that book is supposed to play that role. Right? Well, if we could consider Muslims, Jews, and Christians as people of the book, then I think it's just and fitting to refer to Unitarian Universalists as people of the books, plural, right? People of the books, right? Because our written sources of knowledge and wisdom are far-ranging and far-reaching. We draw inspiration and wisdom not just from one book in one religious tradition, or even from all the books in one religious tradition, right? We draw from all the world's religions, including indigenous and earth-centered traditions. And we draw from humanistic and scientific literature. I find that you use, and I've been, connected with your congregation for about 50 years now, right? I've found that you use are likely to feel enriched and inspired by a chapter in a great novel, or a verse from a poem, or a Buddhist tale, or a Native American prayer, or a treatise on the latest discoveries in quantum physics and the origin of the universe, just as enriched and inspired as they may be by a passage from a so-called good book. In fact, in many cases, much more so. And one of the most attractive features of Unitarian Universalism for me is that it doesn't demand that I diminish and oversimplify the process of intellectual and spiritual development by relying on just one book. One book produced by one culture in one language in one era of human history. When you put it that way, it sounds kind of absurd, doesn't it? I'm not handed one book alleged to contain all I need to know on earth and all I need to know. Right? My spirit isn't confined between the covers of one book. Instead, I'm urged to discover that revelation didn't begin and end some thousands of years ago. For you, Hughes, revolution is an ongoing, never-ending process. And so, you, Hughes, keep on reading. Right? I've spoken with many, many UUs who attest to the importance of certain books in their lives, and we've heard in past years from people, Francesca's talking about the experience of one person in the concentration camp last year, Sequestro Uomo, if this be a man, right, and other things like that. But what do we find? That when you talk about them, I've never heard one UU ever say that they all they ever needed or wanted to know, they found in just one book. Have you? Seriously, have you? Right? Our faith derives from many sources, and those sources multiply throughout our lives. They don't diminish, they multiply, right? We're compelled by our innate, insatiable drive to learn more about the world we live in, and about what it means to live in it, what it means to be fully, wholly human, what it means to be a spiritual being. I mentioned in my opening remarks that our UU faith is principle-based. You know, as Unitarian Universalists, we're not bound to recite a specific creed, to adopt a prescribed set of beliefs that we believe are deemed forever true and unquestionable. That doesn't mean we believe nothing, or that nothing is sacred to us, or that nothing is asked of us. Our religious practice asks much of us. It asks that we affirm and promote principles such as the inherent worth and dignity of every person, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, democratic processes, justice and equity in human affairs, respect for the interdependent web of existence of which we're all a part. I mean, I get worn out just trying to remember all those principles, let alone try to live by them. And the commitment we make to affirm and promote those principles implies that we do have a fundamental article of faith. It really does, doesn't it? It suggests that we believe that our principles will help us not only to become more loving, compassionate, and free individuals, but also to live a more ethical, moral, meaningful, and fulfilling life in community with others. Which brings me to the subject of this morning's service. I mean, how do we come to realize more deeply, more fully, what those principles mean? Why they're so vital, and why and how we can best put them into practice? We derive answers by living every day. We also derive much from reading, however, from immersing ourselves in the recorded experience of other people. And that's why for me, and I would guess for many of you, reading is an essential spiritual practice, like meditation or prayer or whatever you engage in, contemplation. And you know, scientific research verifies the many benefits of reading, from reducing stress to increasing motivation. You know, there was a study that said that 6 minutes of reading had a greater effect on reducing stress than any other practice, including meditation, by the way. Yeah. from mitigating depression to slowing age-related cognitive decline. There's just a study done a couple years ago that, you know, studied the aging brain and the onset of dementia. The people who read, generally, that process was slower and developed at a later age. Right? Okay. But I think one benefit trumps all others for me. Reading connects us with ourselves and with others, even others we would otherwise not even know about, let alone come to know as if they were revered role models or mentors, or cherished family members and friends. So I'm eager to learn what Nicole Russer, Francis Provost, and Joanne Walker have gleaned from books that impressed them and made them more aware of the past and the present, of themselves and of others. And well, first up this morning is Nicole Russer. Nicole is a member of our congregation and has been a frequent participant in our book discussions and has sung with our choral group, Fellowship Singers, right? Books bring so many characters, real and imagined, into our lives, don't they? The book Nicole's chosen to talk about features an improbable real-life hero, a person I'd never heard of, and I suspect most of you haven't, let alone heard of her importance in helping the Allies in World War II. I'm curious to know more about her and her exploits. Nicole, the mic is yours.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Am I good? There we go. Okay. My name's Nicole Russer. Thank you, Jerry, for that introduction. And this summer, I read Codename Madeline, A Sufi Spy in Nazi-Occupied Paris by Arthur J. Magida. It's the biography of Noor Inayat Khan, who was the first female wireless operator to work for the British in Paris. When Noor arrived in France in 1943, the average Allied wireless operator lasted 6 weeks. She evaded arrest by the Nazis for 4 months. Working under the code name Madeline, her transmissions helped to plan sabotage of Nazi supply lines and to rebuild the Allied Parisian spy networks, which had just been decimated by arrests. She even helped lay the groundwork for D-Day the following year. After the war, she was awarded the French Croix de Guerre and the British George Cross. These are extraordinary achievements for anyone, but Noor was an unlikely war hero. She was sensitive, soft-spoken, guileless, eager to please. People often underestimated her age. She wholly believed in the teachings of her late father, Hazrat Inayat Khan, a Sufi Muslim who emphasized honesty and nonviolence. But Hazrat Inayat Khan also taught his students and his 4 children duty and self-discipline, to serve others without fail, and to never shirk from the realities of evil in this world. Noor was determined to fight the Nazis as best she could without committing violence herself. While her training officers worried about her clumsiness or her very sweet nature, they couldn't fault her commitment to the Allied cause. And she did have some things going for her. She'd lived in a suburb of Paris for most of her life, so she knew the city and she spoke French like a native. She had worked as a wireless operator at an RAF base in Oxford for 2 years before being recruited by intelligence. So she had a lot more wireless experience than most of her fellow recruits and was known to be fast and accurate on wireless. From letters, post-war interviews, and other records, Magida details Noor's movements in and around Paris, changing her hairstyle constantly, moving apartments on short notice, traveling everywhere with her wireless in a bulky suitcase. She often struggled to find places to string up its 70-foot antenna. She even broke protocol and approached some pre-war friends for places to stay and transmit and receive messages for just a few days at a time. Magida describes in one scene Noor once crying from fear and exhaustion in the kitchen of her childhood best friend. When the Nazis finally captured Madeline, they held her in relative comfort in Parisian apartments turned SS headquarters. There, rather than tell any lies under interrogation, Noor remained silent. She tried to escape twice. After the second time, she was told that she could remain in her current quarters if she signed a contract promising no future escape attempts. If she broke the contract, 12 other Allied prisoners would be shot on her behalf. Of the three prisoners involved in that second escape attempt, one signed the contract. Nora was one of the other two who refused to sign. She was sent to Germany and held in solitary confinement for nearly a year before being transferred to Dachau and executed on September 13, 1944. Even in the final section of the book, on what little we know about the last 10 months of her life, there are glimmers of hope that make Nora's death feel even more tragic. She would take solace in the company of other Allied prisoners, even if they could only communicate through messages scratched on the back of mess tins, or even if they were riding a train deeper into Germany, probably suspecting what awaited them at the end. This book has extensive references, but it avoids getting bogged down. The second half kind of reads like a spy novel at times. The first half details Nora's early life before the war, and it reads like the cozy biography of a philosopher or an artist. Her family was well-educated, well-traveled, financially secure. Before the war, the greatest hardship Nora faced was the premature death of her father, which left her and her three younger siblings caring for her emotionally fragile mother. As a young woman, Nora studied music and child psychology. She wrote poetry and fables for children. She even had a sweetheart that her Indian uncles did not approve of. I kept waiting for the turning point where she would kind of toughen up, develop more of the character traits we would associate with a future spy, and that point never came. The moral convictions were in her from an early age. The sweetness and femininity never left. I've been trying to understand why Nora took the assignment to Paris. Nobody would have faulted her for continuing her excellent work at the RAF base in Oxford for the duration of the war. And she must have known that she wasn't the toughest, coolest woman for the job. Some of the mistakes she made are downright exasperating for the reader, but her work as Madeleine was a net gain for the Allies. So I think she just pushed her weaknesses aside and focused on what needed to be done and how she could contribute. And for that, her story is inspiring.
Thank you, Nicole. Our next speaker, just serendipitously, also selected a book that takes us back to France during the Second World War. Troubled Sleep was the third in a series of novels by French author, playwright, and existential philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre. The series was titled Le Chemin de la Liberté, Paths to Freedom. Like Noa in Yat Khan, Sartre's characters are forced to choose how to respond to the dissolution of the world they knew and to the chaotic, cruel, dangerous, and treacherous world created by the Nazi regime in France and, of course, all across Europe. Frances Provost is a friend of our fellowship, and I'm eager to hear her take on Jean-Paul Sartre's La Mort dans l'âme, titled, not all that literally in English, Troubled Sleep.
I didn't know the title, Iron in the Soul. Sartre, if you remember, a French philosopher, existentialism, 1905 to 1980. The title, imagine you are waking from a terrible nightmare. And when you wake up, you realize it's actually happening to you. But as you go through life, you find it's not as bad as you think it was yet. The novel eventually covers a bunch of people from early June 1940 to later in August. Their responses, the daily problems they have, how they deal with them. There are groups of soldiers in a prison camp who are treated nicely. The Germans allow the families to visit them. They are not treated unkindly. And that's about it. Any questions? Yeah. It's how the people react to it. They're given circumstances and their reactions to it.
Into the theme of the three novels, The Paths to Freedom. What path to freedom does this book point out?
Path to freedom. I don't know exactly how he meant the path to freedom. You have to go through life, you have to deal with it, and take it as it is.
Our final speaker this morning is Joanne Walker. Joanne is an avid reader, and no slouch as a writer either, as discovered from her participation in our TPUF Writers Group, which met again yesterday morning. She's an environmental attorney, and her interest in the law and how it's applied compels her to follow, carefully and thoughtfully, the decisions handed down in our nation's courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court. And given the controversy generated by recent Supreme Court decisions, I can hardly think of a book more timely and relevant than the one she's chosen to discuss, The Supermajority, How the Supreme Court Divided America.
Thanks, Jerry. Is this okay? Okay. So I'm here today to talk to you about this book, which I think even in its title, though, is a bit of a misnomer. It's not the Supreme Court that divided America. We were divided long before this supermajority was appointed, okay? But the book does take us through, historically, other times where we have been divided as a country. And it's interesting to try to put that history in context with what has been going on the last two Supreme Court terms, if not three or four before that. So just to tell you, I'm a Supreme Court junkie. I have been a Supreme Court junkie for a very long time. I sit there and I wait in June for the decisions to come out, and I read them all, the ones, at least the ones I'm interested in. I sit there and read every word. And now that I get to listen to the arguments live on the Supreme Court's website, I enjoy sitting there yelling at the justices and the lawyers from the sidelines, and they can't hear me, so it's fine. So I found this book just sort of by accident. The TPUF book discussion group read one of Waldman's earlier books on the Second Amendment, and this book was published at the end of June of this year. In fact, it came out right in the middle of decision month. So it was interesting, and it explores what you might call the tumultuous 2021-22 term of the Supreme Court, using the court's opinions and, as I said, history to put things into some level of context for us. It focuses on three Supreme Court decisions that were issued over 3 days in June of 2022. The first is Bruin, which struck down New York City's century-old public carry gun licensing law. The second was Dobbs, which most of us know about, which overturned the 49-plus-year-old Roe versus Wade decision in holding that the Constitution no longer protects the right to an abortion. And the third is West Virginia versus EPA, which was the one I paid the most attention to because it deals with the Clean Air Act. And in that case, the court relied expressly upon what it calls the major questions doctrine for the first time in a majority opinion, and it basically held that a federal agency lacked authority to issue a regulation. And I'll go into a little bit more detail, but I wanted to talk first about some of the historical and political context that Waldman gives us, and that I think it's helpful to us in not being freaked out completely by what's going on. So first, the Constitution doesn't say very much about what the Supreme Court is supposed to do. And if anyone wants to see it, I carry it around in my purse all the time. So it was the fourth Chief Justice, John Marshall, who essentially introduced the concept of judicial review in the court's decision in Marbury versus Madison in 1803. And most of us learned about that either in high school or college or law school or wherever. The current situation with the court, this 6-3 supermajority, is not the first time that the Supreme Court has veered from the public will and thereby provoked controversy and backlash. Think about the Dred Scott decision before the Civil War. Many believe it was one of the main factors leading to the Civil War. Or the nine old men during the early years of Franklin Roosevelt's administration who tried to stop the New Deal in its tracks. Or even the Warren Court, known as the decider of rights-expanding cases ranging from school desegregation to criminal defendant protections to contraceptive, issues that were not always popular with the public. Another point is Roe versus Wade. Waldman and many other attorneys, legal scholars, professors, and even me, believe that the decision in Roe versus Wade was poorly reasoned and weak, and it probably was lucky that it wasn't overturned before 2022. Surprisingly, Waldman's criticism of the left, because he is the president and CEO of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School, which is a bit of a left-leaning organization, he's quite pointed in his criticism of the left. He posits that the left of this period in our history has relied too heavily on the Supreme Court to advance its policies and agenda, rather than on the legislative and executive branches. And because of this, the political muscles of the left have basically atrophied, and it has made more issues vulnerable to a super conservative Supreme Court majority. It makes sense when you think about it. Things that we could have put into law legislatively and through the executive branch, they weren't done. 49 years, we never had a law about a federal law on abortion. So finally, he notes the increased distance between the people and the Supreme Court today. It is worth noting that the Republican appointees have not dominated this court since 1970. We really don't think about it that way, but it's true. Also, Democrats have won the popular vote, what, 7 out of the last 8 elections, but Republicans have appointed 6 of the current 9 justices. So with that context in mind, I just wanted to give you I'll try to be as short as possible. I could talk for days on this, but I won't, and there will not be a test at the end. So the Second Amendment case, the gun rights case, Bruin. The Second Amendment reads, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. 27 words. So if you use the court's current concept of originalism, which is what they tout all the time, which means basically taking the Constitution's words in their plain and simple meaning at the time they were written, and looking at the circumstances at the time it was written, then the court's decision in Bruin makes no sense. In writing for the majority, Clarence Thomas completely ignored what Waldman in the book calls overwhelming evidence throughout history, both pre-colonial in Europe and here, that prohibitions on carrying concealed weapons were totally acceptable. But he also ignored the first 13 words of the amendment completely. It's not that big. And the only other place I see that so well published is on the headquarters of the NRA in DC, where they skip the well-regulated militia part and just have the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So the Bruin case is bad, and but it doesn't make a lot of sense. And from a legal point of view, it's poorly written and reasoned, and it'll get overturned somewhere down the line, but it will be a long time. Abortion, the Dobbs case. This decision, as I said, overturned half a century of law which held that there was a constitutional right to abortion, again, based in part upon the concept of originalism and the idea of taking the founders' words literally. To take a right away, to say the least, is frightening. Rights such as the right to privacy and the right to gay marriage and many other rights are now threatened because of the way they approach this decision. It's open season on anything that is not specifically set out in the Constitution. That's the way Waldman reads this, and I read it that way too, and I think it's very scary. For years, rights such as privacy have been based upon what are called penumbras. Penumbras are a group of rights derived by implication from other rights explicitly protected in the Bill of Rights. Okay, so it's like kind of an aura that the words in the Bill of Rights give to other things so that they didn't have to spell everything out. But the word penumbra does not appear in the Constitution. The word privacy does not appear in the Constitution. There are lots of things that we take for granted today that don't appear in the Constitution. And why? Because over time, especially when I was in law school, we were taught that the Constitution is a living document, that it was especially meant to be sort of general and vague so that it could adapt itself to the times. But now we're moving backwards, I think, instead of forwards. One I want to spend a little bit more time on is the major questions doctrine. Again, there is nothing in the Constitution that uses the term major questions doctrine. This idea basically holds that the courts will presume that Congress did not delegate to executive agencies issues of, quote, major political or economic significance. It doesn't tell us what major political or economic significance is. It doesn't attempt to define it. So in the West Virginia versus EPA case, the court held that an Obama-era EPA Clean Air Act regulation that set a goal of the year 2030 for power plants to eliminate carbon dioxide emissions as a means to address climate change was unconstitutional because it violated the major questions doctrine. For a number of reasons, in my view, there shouldn't have even been a court decision in this case. There was no ripe issue. The regulation was no longer in effect. It had been stayed by the Supreme Court and withdrawn by the Trump administration. And I hate to say this for the Trump administration, who said coal was, you know, everything to us, but the 2030 goals were already met by 2019 because it was cost effective. So even though the issue was moot, the court decided to take it up anyway. And again, not only did it say that these regulations were of major political significance, which, remember, the major questions doctrine is political or economic significance, they found it was both. And or are real important in anything that comes out from lawyers, okay? So this puts many, many other regulations that are in existence at risk, because over the course of the years, the courts and the Congress have gotten to the somewhat comfortable with the idea that agencies have expertise on certain areas and can make better choices than a bunch of elected congresspeople or the Supreme Court. Okay, the Supreme Court, I could probably count on one hand how many environmental cases the Supreme Court has heard up until recently. Environmental laws started as early as the 50s. So they don't, and they didn't take them because they didn't understand them. So this year's decision, just to show you how the major questions doctrine works, is this year's decision on the student loan forgiveness also was based on the major questions doctrine. And even though it's their doctrine, they used it improperly in the student loan case. Student loan case isn't addressed in the book. He sort of talks about it, like what he thinks will happen, because his book came out as those decisions were coming out. But the court held that the Secretary of Education was not delegated the power to forgive student loans when the HEROES Act, which was the basis for the program, specifically did delegate to the secretary the power to take such steps in a national emergency, such as the pandemic. So basically what they did here was they decided the outcome they wanted, and then they tried to fit it into some legal theory, and they didn't do a very good job. And they ignored what Sonia Sotomayor points out in a dissent, is the facts. The facts being that, you know, you can't read a law one way or the other. It has to be read precisely. Now, just as an aside, Neil Gorsuch is the person on the court who is the father of the major questions doctrine. And he's been on a crusade about the power of administrative agencies since he was a kid, because his mother was fired as the administrator of the EPA and indicted. So it's interesting to put all these things together, right? So Waldman, however, he doesn't spend much time addressing the other threats posed by this 6-3 supermajority. He barely mentions the cases dealing with the First Amendment's religious protections. But in both 2021 and 2022, the court held that businesses can deny services to LGBTQ individuals based upon the business owner's claimed religious beliefs. First, we had the Masterpiece Cake case, and then we had the 303 Creative case, which is about the website. These cases dealt with the Free Exercise Clause, or what regular people call the freedom of speech, okay? And, you know, the idea being that both cases were Colorado cases, and the court said their non-discrimination law violated the business owner's right to free exercise of religion. Two other decisions before I close up out of 2022 are of concern, and they deal with the Establishment Clause, the entanglement of government with religion, supporting religion. In Kennedy versus Bremerton School District, this was the one we all saw it on the news about the coach who was praying at the 50-yard line and people objected, right? And but all the players and the parents and the school administrators were all around them at the 50-yard line. The court held that this was not a violation of the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, despite the fact that the coach was an authority figure. So it seemed like the school district was, you know, supporting this. Interestingly, Sotomayor catches them again. She includes in her dissenting opinion photographs of the coach praying and surrounded by players, parents, school administrators, and spectators, and then says, isn't this not enough to support an Establishment Clause violation? And she's right. So the last case that came up, and Waldman talks a little bit about it and sort of predicting the cases, and is Carson versus Macon, which we didn't hear too much about. And It's out of Maine, and Maine provides private school tuition vouchers to students in rural areas where there is no high school. Not every place in Maine has enough people for a high school. The court held that they must allow students to use these vouchers in religious schools. And the court said that it is not a violation of the Establishment Clause. But let me tell you, since the Carson decision, which was only a year ago, Oklahoma has authorized two Roman Catholic dioceses to operate a charter school, which will essentially be a state-funded religious school. It's being challenged by the ACLU, but not in federal court where all of this usually happens. It is being challenged in state court as a strategy to avoid the supermajority. So to wrap this up, we're stuck with these people for a long time. Amy Coney Barrett is only 51. She could be on the court for 40 plus years. If we put term limits in, chances are they won't be retroactive. We could, what about the ethical issues? He doesn't address that, but I hate to say this, but does Congress have the power to impose them on the court? It's really kind of iffy there. And guess who gets to have the last word on whether Congress can impose, you know, ethical regulations on the Supreme Court? The supermajority. Yeah, so I would say that this is an easy read. It's not a law book by any means, and I would highly recommend it if you want to read it. But it really gave me a lot of food for thought and put things into context for me. Thank you. Linda.
I have a question.
I don't think it's a good idea. Because if, let's say we expanded the third to 11. So what's to stop the next Republicans when they get the Senate to add to? And then it'll just be tit for tat, because that's the way government works now. And it'll become too big to manage it. That's my view on it, unfortunately.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I'm glad you hit the major questions doctrine. I thought, gee, what a transparent fig leaf to try to put on a bad decision. Anyway, okay, well, thank you very much. Well, as you say, we grow, we learn, right? It's time now for Matters of the Heart. We leave time in our service each week for those of us experiencing a joy that is lifting our spirits up, or a concern or sorrow that's weighing our spirits down, to bring that joy or sorrow to the light of our faith community. After a brief musical interlude, we'll give you a chance to think about what you'd like to say. We'll open the mic here, I think, and share our joys and concerns.
So we will bring this time of sharing to a close. We're going to be singing Spirit of Life. The lyrics will show up on the screen here in just a second.
We'll extinguish our chalice, and I'll share with you some closing words. We extinguish our chalice, but never, of course, that light which we take with us in our hearts to share with those whose lives we touch and whose lives touch our own. And I'll close our service this morning with words by journalist, writer, and filmmaker Nora Ephron. Even if you've never read on a page anything she's written, you've no doubt seen her writing in films such as When Harry Met Sally and Sleepless in Seattle. In her autobiography, I Feel Bad About My Neck and Other Thoughts on Being a Woman, Ephron writes, "Reading is everything. Reading makes me feel like I've accomplished something, learned something, become a better person. Reading makes me smarter. Reading gives me something to talk about later on. Reading is the unbelievably healthy way my attention deficit disorder medicates itself. Reading is escape and the opposite of escape. It's a way to make contact with reality after a day of making things up. And it's a way of making contact with someone else's imagination after a day that's all too real. Reading is grist. Reading is bliss. Reading is grist, reading is bliss, and reading well, what is well worth reading, I think is a spiritual practice." And I'll leave you with one final thought about books and reading. It's a profound insight from that famous American philosopher and literary critic, Groucho Marx. "Outside of a dog," Groucho once said, "a book is man's best friend. Inside of a dog, it's too dark to read."